Please be seated. Morning. Welcome you all to the court's hearing room. And we especially welcome New Glarus High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students in high schools across the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, they're sent materials about this case, and we'll join with a justice for the second case to discuss the procedures that the court uses, not the substantive issues of a case. And everyone is invited to join that discussion. It's not limited to the students. Is there anyone in the courtroom who would like a summary of the case we are about to hear? Just if you raise your hand, we'll give you one. It's easier to understand the case if you understand the oral argument if you have a summary. Okay. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Pat Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet today. Seated to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 08AP919, James Zarder versus Acuity Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Acuity is Attorney Lance Grady. You may proceed.
Good morning.
Morning.
Court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the galley. My name is Lance Grady, and together with Daniel Miller, we have the pleasure of representing the petitioner, Acuity, in this appeal. The focus of this case centers on the Supreme Court's motivation in defining the word run in the term hit and run. Was that an off-the-cuff statement, as suggested by the Court of Appeals, and therefore dicta? Or was it intentionally drafted, knowing that the issue was of substantial importance and likely to reoccur again? If yes, then it's binding precedent. Respondents argue that it is dicta, and they encourage this court to adopt the reasoning of the Court of Appeals. We obviously take issue with that. We are of the opinion that the Court of Appeals overstepped its grounds by concluding that the language of this court was dicta. It then substituted its own judgment and, in effect, latched onto a definition which allowed it to reach a result that it desired. As the Court of Appeals stated, and I quote, "Therefore, Haynes' mention of run is uninformative dicta and not controlling." Uninformative dicta. Those are the words of the Court of Appeals. As Justice Abramson noted in Cook versus Cook, only this court has the power to overrule, modify, or withdraw language from a previous Supreme Court decision. Yet, the Court of Appeals, what they did was, in effect, withdraw the language of this court in the Hain decision by declaring that it was dicta. That the Court of Appeals, by doing so, then, they conveniently opened the door for them to analyze the word run, declare that it's ambiguous, and then substitute their definition for the word. And as we know, the Court of Appeals concludes that run means basically a vehicle that leaves the scene of an accident after checking on whether there is an injury without providing identifying information.
Counsel, what difference does it make whether or not it's dicta? Let's say it's not dicta. Let's say it is precedent that I am embracing with gusto. That is, that run means flee. But then, don't we have to determine what flee means under the circumstances of this case? Does flee mean leaving the scene without stopping? Or does flee mean leaving the scene without providing identifying information as is required? Isn't that the issue?
Your Honor, I think if you look at the Hain decision, the Hain court had the opportunity to latch onto a definition which basically defined run as occurring when a person leaves the scene of an accident without fulfilling their legal requirements. But what we see is that the Hain court did not latch onto that definition. In effect, it came up with its own definition, ascribed its own meaning to the word flee. So I think, Judge, when you look at the facts of this case, we clearly do not have a flee from a common sense standpoint, because the facts show that the occupants of the vehicle checked on the well-being of Zachary Zerner. There was no attempt by them to shield their identity. There was no attempt by them to run from the scene of the accident. I think from a common sense standpoint, that does not constitute fleeing the scene of the accident.
What, in part, it seems to me that in determining what Hain means, it is informative to see what Smith or DeHart says Hain means. And I don't have Smith right in front of me. I did have it. But I have DeHart quoting Smith, which quotes Haynes. And in paragraph 15 of DeHart, it says, although we have established that the term hit and run unambiguously includes an element of physical contact, we recognize that WSSTAT 632.32.4a.2 does not specifically define hit and run. And then it goes into the Ledge Counsel note, which Smith also cites, I think, and so does Theis. So why shouldn't we take Smith's interpretation of what Haynes meant when it discusses Haynes' holding?
Judge, when you look at the criminal hit-and-run statute, section 346.67, there is nothing in that statute that extends its provisions to the omnibus statute. And as Justice Abramson noted in her dissent in the Hain decision, the use of criminal statutes is not significant in interpreting insurance laws. Hain has been the law of this state for 17 years. We know that in Hain, the court defined run as fleeing the scene of the accident. It's a 17-year-old decision, and in that 17 years, the legislature has never taken steps to change that decision. As a result, we submit that this court should follow the Haynes definition, apply those facts, that ruling, to the facts of this case, and conclude that we do not have a situation where the occupants flee the scene of the accident. It is our position that
the question about isn't Smith informative of what the holding in Haynes means? The answer to that is yes or no. I mean, the answer to that is whatever you want, but what is the answer to that?
Your Honor, I think run is defined. Run is defined by the Hain court. And when you look at the analysis that was followed by the Hain court, The Hain Court looked at four different definitions in deciding the meaning of run. There was deliberate thought in place. They didn't adopt any one of those four definitions. In fact, Judge, if you look at those four definitions, they looked at the Webster's definition. Webster's defines hit-and-run accident as a driver guilty of leaving the scene of an accident without stopping to render assistance or to comply with legal requirements. They also looked at the Heritage definition, which defines hit-and-run accident as involving the driver of a motor vehicle who drives on after striking a pedestrian or a motor vehicle. And then they looked at the Funk and Wagnall definition, which defines hit-and-run accident as designating or caused by the driver of a vehicle who illegally continues on his way. And what we see with the Hain Court is that they do not adopt any of those definitions. In fact, the definition they come up with is fleeing the scene of an accident. The word flee does not appear in any of those definitions. So the Hain Court basically ascribed its own meaning to the word run. And I think that's significant, Judge, because I think that is binding precedent.
But just remind me, did the Hain Court fact situation involve flee or run, or was it just a miss or a hit?
Judge, the Hain Court, it was a miss and run case.
Got it. It's not a matter of fleeing.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So they were really only dealing with hit.
That is correct. It was
off at the mouth on run.
It was a miss and run accident. The issue was whether there was a strike. The vehicle, I believe, attempted to avoid another vehicle and rolled over, and then the other vehicle took off.
So why isn't it just dicta? Why should the Court of Appeals, which has to be bound by our decisions, be bound by something that is not relevant to the facts of the case? I didn't check the briefs to see if there were briefs on the word run and whether you had argument on the word run. My guess would be not, because it was not relevant to that case. So why should you bind the Court of Appeals? We hand down roughly 70, sometimes more, cases per year. Court of Appeals deals with 3,500 cases. Why should they be bound by language in our case that is not relevant to any of the facts?
Your Honor, if you look at the dissent by Judge Snyder, as Judge Snyder noted, and I quote, when a court of last resort intentionally takes up, discusses, and decides a question germane to, though not necessarily decisive of, the controversy, such decision is not dicta. It is a judicial act of the court which will thereafter become a binding decision.
If I remember correctly, I think Justice Bradley wrote an opinion that said we got two lines, at least two lines of cases. One line of cases says dicta, dicta, dicta. No, not binding, off the cuff kind of stuff. And another line of cases says, hey, this court says it, we mean it, you follow it. Right?
There is a difference in authority, Your Honor.
Right. So what should the poor Court of Appeals do when they have two lines of authority here? One says whatever we say is it goes. The other one says off the cuff, no stuff.
Your Honor, I think in this case the Court of Appeals was under an obligation to follow the Hain decision. It lacked the power to withdraw or modify or in any way change an earlier decision of this court. That was not the role of the Court of Appeals. It should have followed this court's decision in Hain. If there's going to be modification made to a Supreme Court decision, that is the role of this court. It is not the role of the Court of Appeals.
Seems a little egotistical to me to say, hey, what I say is so important. regardless of whether it's off the cuff or really serious, that everybody has to follow it?
Your Honor, this is the court of last resort in the state of Wisconsin. What this court says is very important. It needs to be followed by the Court of Appeals.
So you think in this case we have to say, at last say, there's no such thing as dicta, whatever we say goes? I mean, should we clean up that issue? Otherwise, what is the Court of Appeals going to know?
No, Your Honor, I think this court has the power to address issues that may not necessarily be germane of the controversy at stake. This court has that power. In fact, as this court well knows, it, you can have a case that may be moot, yet the court still can address issues in that case when those issues are of great public importance, or when the constitutionality of a statute is involved, or when the issue is likely to rise again and should be resolved by the court to avoid uncertainty.
I have another question. The statute has been amended. It doesn't affect your case now. But under the new statute, Ms. Gizarda would be covered, wouldn't he?
It's debatable, Your Honor.
Okay, why?
It depends on whether the third parties in this case, the Millers, can establish a causal connection between the role played by the vehicle and the accident, and we don't know that.
Don't you know that by the affidavit submitted by the Millers? The Millers were right there. They heard the voice of a young boy, according to their affidavit, say a car is coming. They, according to their affidavit, they were present, and they overheard the boy say to the three occupants that he wasn't injured. They, when they came on the scene, they had heard the impact, and according to their affidavit, they saw the car 100 feet from the boy. They saw the occupants walking back. It looks like a third-party corroboration to me, unless they're lying.
No, and I agree with you, Your Honor. That is what their affidavits indicate. However, I think at this point it's unknown as to whether they would be willing to testify, yes, that car was somehow involved in the accident. We know what their affidavits indicate.
Are you suggesting, it's not clear to me, are you suggesting that although their affidavits state what I said, who knows? Maybe they'll refuse to testify. Or, who knows, maybe they'll change their story? Is that what you're suggesting?
Judge,
or is there a third choice? I mean,
no, Judge, when a witness is in a deposition environment, it's amazing how at times their testimony changes. And that is what I'm suggesting, Your Honor. If their testimony is consistent with their affidavits in a deposition format, then I would agree with you. In all probability, we would have corroboration by a third party.
And under the new statute, again, to get at one of the underlying policies of all of this, we don't want fraud. And all of our cases, or at least most of our cases that deal with hit and run, miss and run, it's very important. And Hain discusses it too, an underlying policy. We don't want any fraud. So the law was amended last year to say if that put in a new provision to get rid of the fraud concern. If you have a third party that I can identify the accident and corroborate it, then there's no problem. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. Fraud is always a concern, but even though the statute was amended, it still does not cover all accidents. If you have a miss and run accident that is not verified by a third party, in that case, the omnibus statute would not extend coverage to that accident.
If you had a hit and run that was verified by a third party, does the omnibus statute now require coverage then?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Mr. Grady, let me ask you where we stand as a court system. As against the majority, are we with or against the majority of states in terms of our definition of run? In other words, run equals fleeing.
Judge, as you well know, there is authority on both sides. I think when you look at, in fact, I believe the respondents argued that the majority position is to require the providing of identifying information. Otherwise, it is a hit and run. Judge, but when you look at those cases, when you look at the facts of those cases, I would submit to you that the majority does not hold those positions based on the specific facts that were involved in those cases. Because in a lot of those cases, Judge, there were attempts made by the unknown driver to shield their identity or to take steps to commit fraud, to give false identifying information. And so when you look at the specific facts of each case, I don't think that one can conclude that we're in the minority by not requiring the identifying information.
Counselor, if I'm driving my car and your Maserati is parked at the curb and I run into it and you're not there and I do a whole lot of damage and I stop and I look at the damage and I think, oh boy, and I leave without putting my name and my address and phone number, insurance information or whatever on your windshield so you can contact me. Have we had a hit and run?
From a criminal standpoint?
No, I'm talking about from a civil standpoint. You want to sue me, but you don't know who I am, and you have a very expensive car, and you have a huge amount of UM coverage in your policy. We have a hit and run. Can you claim for that? I stopped, but I could see the damage was quite a lot, so I decided, you know, I'm going to take a pass on this. Is that a hit and run?
Under those circumstances, Judge, we have a strike, and we have, I think, a flee from the scene of the accident.
Well, why is that so different from what we have before us when there's obviously a strike, or at least it appears at this moment, unless people's testimony changes, and they didn't leave their name or address or phone number with the young boy or the people who were also there?
First, Judge, I think we must question, do we have a strike here? From the viewpoint...
That's not the focus of this case. Let's just assume we do for the sake of argument.
Okay?
And then go from there.
I'm getting at, Judge. You got to remember that this occurred on a dark evening in December. If you look at the police report, I believe the officer referenced a scrape on the handlebar and then some minor damage to the wheel of the bike. We also have a situation where Zachary Zarter, he's asked by the occupants, are you okay? They check on his well-being. Zachary Zarter informs them that he's fine, and he then indicates that they can leave the scene of the accident. So under those circumstances, the two scenarios are not parallel.
Well, I don't think they left any identifying information with him, and he's obviously a minor. I mean, he was, what, 12 or something?
13, I believe, 13. Your Honor.
All right. So, you know, he's just a kid. And to me, I frankly see not a whole lot of difference between running into your Maserati and going away. Maybe I pushed your car and so it hit the post that the parking meter's on. And I stopped, and I looked at your car, and I thought, oh, my gosh, thank goodness nothing happened to this expensive car. And I left. But when you get there, the whole right side is caved in at the front where your car was jammed into the post. Don't we still have a hit and run if I haven't left you my name and address?
Judge, the difference is that in the scenario that you presented, we have verifiable physical damage. We don't have that in the Zachary Zarter case.
Well, the child has a broken arm and a broken leg, is my understanding.
That is,
he thinks he's damaged.
That is correct, Your Honor, but you must remember that Zachary told the occupants of the vehicle when they checked on his well-being that he was fine. And, Judge, we also have two adults that are present, those being the Millers. And they also inquired as to whether he was okay. And he indicated that he was. And then,
if he were 5 years old, would you think they would have accepted his statement that he was okay?
Judge, under those circumstances, I believe what we would have seen was the adults would have stepped in and in all probability called 911. Here we're dealing here with a teenager.
I know we are, but my concern is with an accident between a bicyclist, and frankly, I would probably feel the same way if Zachary had been 21 years old instead of 13. I mean, it just strikes me as very unusual that one of these men, the driver, hopefully, would have left his name and number. just like you would like my name and number if I ran into your car.
But, Judge, if I then say, look, I looked at my car, Your Honor, and there's no damage, you may go. Under those circumstances, Judge, that's not fleeing the scene of the accident. When I'm dismissed from the scene, when the person that has been struck says, look, I'm fine, you guys may take off. Under those circumstances, that is not fleeing the scene of the accident as defined by the Hayne court.
Is there testimony from Zachary telling the guys, yes, you guys can leave, or just I'm okay?
There are statements. There is a statement in the police accident report verified by the police officer that he indicated to the occupants that they could leave. That is in the police report.
Is that his statement or is that the statement of the Millers?
No, Your Honor. That is the statement of Zachary Zarter, according to the investigating police officer.
Because I recalled the Millers affidavit. I thought that the Millers affidavit indicated that they overheard that he told them that he was okay.
Your Honor, if you look at page 101 in the petitioner's appendix, that is the New Berlin Police Department report. The officer indicates that he told the occupants he was uninjured and that they could leave.
Thank you.
So I submit to the court that Hayne is not dicta. Hayne is binding precedent that the Court of Appeals was obligated to follow.
What does flee mean then? Obviously, flee means, as listening to your answers to Justice Rogensack, you can stop. You know, you can stop for seconds, you can stop for a while, you can look at the damage. So fleeing doesn't mean, you know, press the pedal to the metal. Obviously, what does fleeing mean? What's your definition of fleeing?
Your Honor, flee means run, as established by the Hayne court.
What if you walk away fast? Or what if you walk away slow? I think you still would be fleeing, don't you think?
If you walk away slow and the person that is struck asks you to leave your name and you fail to do so, or if you leave a false name, in my opinion, that would constitute fleeing the accident.
Right, but I think you would agree that if I didn't leave my name and address on your car, even though I stopped and I left, and I knew there was damage on your car, I think you would want to make a claim saying I fled the scene of the accident. Whether I drove away slowly or quickly, I bet wouldn't make any difference.
See, and Justice, that's a significant point that you raise, is that you knew you had caused property damage, and yet...
But that you see, you're shifting the focus on me. I'm talking about leaving a locus where there's been an accident, okay? Forget the property damage. What I'm saying to you is my leaving is what's causing the hit-and-run availability for the car that I've damaged. It's my leaving, and you don't know who I am, so I fall within the parameters of an unidentified motorist. I don't think it matters whether I go away fast or whether I go away slow. I don't think it matters if I drive 50 miles away or I creep away. I think it's still going to be a fleeing the scene of the accident.
Justice, I see my time is up.
Well, you may have...
You can respond. I mean, I didn't mean to shut you down there.
Justice Brasser?
If you had a 13-year-old son in the same position of Zachary, what would you say to your son that he should have done under these circumstances?
Judge, when my son was 13, he thought he was 21.
And when he's 21, he thinks he's 13.
That's correct. I guess my advice to my son was that under those circumstances, he should have called 911.
Mm-hmm. And what would he have done until somebody arrived?
Thank you.
Well, if he believes he has an injury, clearly he should remain at the scene with the two adults and at least get the name of the person that was driving the vehicle. The question here is, when he dismisses the occupants of the vehicle and they then drive off, that just does not constitute fleeing the scene of the accident. If he had asked for their name or if they had given false identification, In my opinion, that would constitute a flip.
Well, perhaps he didn't realize that he'd been injured. Sometimes injuries occur and the victims don't always discover the injury at the moment that it's inflicted. With all possible respect, you seem to be shifting to Zachary some fault here. If I understand the facts, he was injured. There was an accident. He was injured. It's not that other people were bad necessarily, but he was injured, and somehow people have to figure out how do they conduct themselves personally and how do they prepare for their family so that in this kind of an incident there will be coverage. And with all possible respect, you seem to be saying that the victim and the Zarder family didn't do enough here.
Judge, when the driver of the unidentified vehicle goes up to the victim.
Okay. We want to record every word here.
I'm sorry. And checks on the victim's well-being. And if that victim says, I'm fine, you guys may leave the accident scene. Under those circumstances, that just does not constitute fleeing the scene of an accident from a common sense standpoint. If the person says, I'm fine, what happens if he discovers an injury a week later? If he dismisses the party from the accident scene, if they're willing to help him out, they're checking on his well-being, they're willing to call an ambulance, and he says, look, I'm fine, leave me alone, I'm okay. If he rejects their assistance, how can that be labeled as that person fled the scene of the accident? Accordingly, we're asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I would suggest that maybe you think that, and you could tell us when rebuttal, that flee has the meaning in 346.67, which is a duty to report.
I will, Your Honor.
You think about that. Now, that requires an accident resulting in injury. Here, the young man says no injury, or in damage to a vehicle, and 346 defines vehicle to being bicycle, which was damaged. So maybe that's the way to define flee.
I'd be happy to address that in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Luke Wagner, representing the plaintiffs, the Zarders.
May it please the court, may it please counsel, and all that are present. I'm Luke Wagner, and I represent with co-counsel Robert Bernard, plaintiff respondents in this case, James, Glory, and Zachary Zarder, representing oral argument on their behalf this morning. This case is about the definition of run and hit-and-run accident caused by an unidentified motorist. Acuity presents the definition of run as fleeing from the scene of an accident. It comes up with this definition not from its Acuity insurance policy in effect on the day of the accident, and not by the omnibus statute, Wisconsin Stat Section 632.32, Section 4A, 2B, but rather from essentially a 27-year-old case, Haynes v. Progressive Insurance Company, that was decided by this court. However, in that case, as stated by the majority opinion, the sole issue was whether or not the omnibus statute required uninsured motorist coverage for an accident involving an insured vehicle and an unidentified motor vehicle when no physical contact occurred between the two vehicles. Essentially, whether or not a miss-and-run accident would be covered under the uninsured motorist coverage for hit-and-run accidents. That's the only definition that they come up with is from that case. It is our position that that is dicta by this court. The court spent 17 pages of its majority opinion specifically analyzing the hit requirement in a hit-and-run accident and determined that it was a striking. In passing, it indicates that a run is a fleeing from the scene of the accident.
Does it say anything in that case about whether you have to run away fast or slow, or if you walk, or anything about the speed that's involved in fleeing?
I didn't see anything in that case, Your Honor, regarding the speed.
Counsel, part of what bothers me in this case is all around the state today, in particular, probably because of the snowstorm, people are going to, at stop signs or stop lights, roll into the car in front of them. They'll maybe have cars might touch. The people get out. They look at their car. They say, hey, no damage here. See ya. And they go on their merry way. Happens all the time. It's happened to me when I lived in Milwaukee, and it happens to other people. I'm certain of that. And you say, okay, yeah, there's really nothing here. See ya. And you go. Is that a hit and run?
Well, Your Honor, you indicated that there was no damage to the vehicle, and therefore it would not, and I'm assuming there would be no injury under your scenario.
These people assume no injury, too. They were told, hey, everything's fine. See ya. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out how this, because this won't just stick to the facts of this case. This will be used in a lot of different scenarios. Will we now, in every possible situation, have to exchange information when both sides are saying, okay, you know, we're causing a traffic jam here. There's no damage. There's no problem. See ya.
Well, Your Honor.
Because property, the duty to report, it has to be $1,000 or a government-owned vehicle or a personal injury, right? So you're not going to call the police over something like that. You're not going to call 911 over something like that. You're not going to be late for, you know, going home to cook dinner for your family over something like that. It happens all the time. How will we change or impact those everyday situations that happen in this state?
Well, Your Honor, if there's no damage to the property and there's no injury, Wisconsin Statute Section 346.67 does not require the driver to provide identifying information. And if the driver of the vehicle that was not injured and vehicle did not sustain any damage says go on your way, that's really the end of it. Because
but here's from whose perspective is really the kicker. Is it from the stop, you know, the person who drove the car and has stopped to say, is everything okay? Is it when they know or are told there's no problem here, does that allow them to leave? Or at what point, what do they have to do to be free to go?
Well, Your Honor.
Because here, they didn't think, they were told from this young man, I feel sorry for him, okay? I absolutely do. I have an almost 13-year-old right now at home, and I think this, you know, is a sad scenario. Having said that, I'm trying to think of those more practical, everyday things that happen.
Well, Your Honor, if there's damage or injury, or there perceives to be damage or injury, Wisconsin Section 346.67 must be followed by the vehicle operator that did the striking, must provide their contact information, name, address, registration number of their vehicle, and also provide an operating license upon request. That's what the statute requires, shall provide this information. It should be a situation where, really, from the purposes of the person doing the striking, should always provide their information in case there's any problems you're not aware of. That would be the best situation for everyone involved. Because if there's ever a situation down the road where, no, there is an injury from this, we have an identified person who would be liable pursuant to their bodily injury coverage.
I think we're looking at the wrong end of the case. I mean, I suggested that 346.67 be used to define flee for purposes of this case. But the fact that these people left and didn't give their identification. We're not saying in this case, and I don't think the Court of Appeals says, that they're bad people or that they're at fault. The issue in this case is, this is what happened. Who's covered under this insurance policy? Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I don't know that we have to worry about whether what a person is supposed to do. And that's not this case. In this case, whether they violated the law or not in not leaving their identification is irrelevant. Is it? Isn't that right?
Yes.
And what's relevant is, on the facts, they did leave. They're not identifiable. They did stop. They left. Is that fleeing? Right?
Right.
How do you define flee?
Well, define flee is leaving the scene of an accident. I've been waiting to hear the distinction from Acuity's position of when a flee begins and when a flee ends.
I shouldn't ask flee. What's the language in the stat in the policy? Run?
Run.
Okay. Run. What does run mean? Would run mean the policy, right?
It's not defined in the policy at all, Your Honor.
Okay, so what does it mean to you?
As a reasonable person, it means to me that when you leave a scene of an accident, you're fleeing the scene. Doesn't matter how fast, doesn't matter if you stopped, say you left the scene. That's a flee.
Where do you get that definition from?
Reasonable interpretation of what's anticipated for a hit-and-run accident is that there's numerous reasonable positions that can be taken as far as definition when someone says hit-and-run. It can be as egregious as someone who has no care about the person at all, just flies by, strikes them, continues leaving at 90 miles an hour. Also, as far as a person leaving the scene of an accident and not meeting the legal requirements to provide identifying information.
That's what you really mean. Leave the scene of the accident without giving identifying information and meeting all the requirements in the statute. Because, I mean, if you give all that information and then leave, that's not a run.
Well, then we're not in an unidentified motor vehicle situation that would
Right. So, I mean, it can't just be leaving the scene of an accident, because everyone leaves the scene of an accident at some point. So it has to be leaving without meeting the statute's requirements.
Without being identified.
So in that just touching of cars, where they both get out and say, they're at, you know, everybody's honking their horns behind them in Milwaukee, and they get out and they say there's no damage here, those people need to exchange full information, otherwise they've engaged in a hit and run.
Once again, it looks at whether or not there's damage or injury.
But let's just assume they don't think there's any damage, and then later somebody in the car says, you know, my baby's kicking. Or someone says, you know, my neck hurts. And that happens a week later. Those things happen. Where a week later someone says, well, I think that was tethered to that person tapping my bumper.
Well, Your Honor, as far as leaving the scene of the accident in that situation, for the purposes of uninsured motorist coverage, if there was the damage, hit and run, I would say that does define run for leaving the scene of the accident. It's a matter of burden of proof is upon the person that's injured to demonstrate that that was the reason that they sustained this injury.
So it's just a hard and fast rule. You must always exchange information whenever two vehicles come into contact, no matter how large or how small, because otherwise you could be subject to hit and run a week, a month, a year later. Right? Well, you must do that. It has to be a hard and fast rule. There's no practical common sense at all. I mean, those people who get out, look at the car and say, eh, no problem. They can't do that anymore. I'm just trying to figure out how we reconcile that.
Well, Your Honor, as far as leaving the scene of the accident, as far as not providing identifying information, if it's required because there's a damage to the vehicle, injury to the person, that is something that must be provided based on 346.6.
I don't disagree with you, but what if you don't know?
If no one knows, then you're in a situation where you're unable to identify this person, so you're left out in the cold, essentially, of... If we had obtained identifying information, there would be insurance coverage, either from that person's insurance, or if they had no insurance, then we'd have uninsured motorist coverage. But then there's a gap that's put in there that says, because you let this person leave, therefore you're to be punished for it, and you can't obtain any type of compensation under uninsured motorist coverage. And that's the gap that...
So it has to be a hard and fast rule, no matter how large or how small. That's the rule you're asking us to implement, I think. I'm just trying to figure it out as a practical, everyday sort of application. It has to be, then, you must always exchange, because you don't know what a week or a month might bring.
And, Your Honor, as far as that is concerned, is that in a situation where someone would not consider that a flee for the purposes of uninsured motorist coverage, then essentially the duty is upon the person that may or may not have an injury to obtain that information from the other driver, which is not a legal duty that's set forth at this point.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. I'm just trying to figure out what's being asked for today.
Counsel, what are the obligations under the terms of the policy for a claimant for coverage for hit and run?
Your Honor, the policy indicates that within 24 hours after the accident, the police had to be contacted, which in this case they were within 24 hours after Zachary Zarter left the scene, spoke with his parents, he had complaints of injury, and his parents contacted the police.
The other duty under the policy is the duty to cooperate. So there are two duties under the terms of the policy, a duty to cooperate and a duty to report to the police the accident within 24 hours. It seems to me intuitively that the duty to report the accident to the police within 24 hours emanates again from this concern for fraud. You know, what if the injury doesn't show up for a month later? What if the accident damage doesn't show up for 2 weeks later? That if the claimant doesn't fulfill the duty under the policy of notifying the police of the incident within 24 hours, I assume that there will be a real question of whether or not coverage may attend.
I would agree, Your Honor. The contract would be controlling in that matter, most likely.
The contract would say that's your obligation. Two obligations. Cooperate with us, report within 24 hours the incident to police.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Counsel, do you think that
that was done here within 24 hours?
Yes.
It was reported.
Do you think that in a judicial system for good administration, the Court of Appeals should follow the Supreme Court, regardless of whether it's dicta or not?
Your Honor, I believe when looking at dicta, the Court of Appeals is in a position to rule on a matter, and I believe that when it finds what is reasonably believed to be dicta, that it should do an independent review of that issue. Otherwise, it can lead to absurd results.
Mr. Wagner, how do you reconcile that with a number of cases issued by this court that basically say when this court speaks on a subject, takes the time to discuss the subject, that there is no dicta in our opinions? How do we handle that in the future?
Your Honor, as far as there has to be a description of when and when this won't apply on as far as dicta is concerned, because to me, reading a case, and that the way I read Hain, is that the reason the court set out we're addressing the sole issue, the specific issue, is so that's what that case stands for. And that's the reason that things are limited to that degree in a case.
Don't you think that the court in Hain was also trying to give guidance to the lower courts in Wisconsin in terms of not only hit but also run? Otherwise, why would there be any definition at all provided in regard to run?
Your Honor, I'm unaware reading that case how that definition was selected. As far as it providing guidance, it provides a alternative term when it indicates run as fleeing from the scene of the accident. But there again lies the problem. When does a flee begin? What is a flee? And that's not defined in the Hain case.
Well, if we're going to change the definition from Hain, in other words, we're either going to add to it or we're going to in some way change that definition, do you think that part of that change or addition would have to take into account whether or not the person that stopped had a conversation with the victim? I'm thinking about the kinds of things that Justice Ziegler was asking about. Is that not a significant factor, whether or not the individual that strikes someone else, stops, gets the opportunity to talk to the victim? Should that be part of what we consider, part of our definition?
Well, Your Honor, as far as the stop issue, once again, as far as what's going to constitute a stop. Is it going to only be a stop if the person stops the vehicle, has a discussion, and actually has a meaningful discussion or an attempt to have a meaningful discussion? Or is it going to include a potential where someone strikes a vehicle, stops, looks out the window, and then drives off? Is that sufficient enough to end the flee? Or is it a situation where you have to continually have your foot on the gas pedal all the way through, or else it's not a flee? And that's, to me, looking at what's reasonable to be applied not only to this case, but in future cases, is a clear distinction. You leave the scene of the accident, doesn't matter if there's a stop or not, you don't provide identifying information, which is the legal duty of that driver.
If there's injury, if there's property damage, that's the legal duty.
Correct.
But here you've got a discussion, as I understand it, with the victim, and the victim says, I'm not injured. Now, you still think there's an obligation to provide that information?
Well, Your Honor, there was the property damage to the bicycle, and therefore I believe there is a legal obligation to provide that that identifying information.
Was there any discussion about whether or not the bike's okay?
I don't believe there was a discussion about it, but the bike was, to my knowledge, plain to see.
Was this at night?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And your injured party, Zachary, as I understand it, didn't have any lights on his bike?
I don't believe he did, Your Honor.
Did this occur, the injury where he was, where they stopped and went and talked to him, was there light in the area? Do you know that? Does the record reflect that?
I'm unaware of that, Your Honor.
Counsel, I too would like to follow up on some of Justice Ziegler's questions. I wonder how much of your argument is contingent upon the fact that Zach was so young at the time of this incident. If we change the facts under a hypothetical where instead of being a person of 13, the person was 50, a 50-year-old man is struck in the same circumstance. The individual operating the motor vehicle which struck him stops, engages in the kind of discussion which took place here, and is assured by the 50-year-old man, who appears by all reasonable observation to be okay, that he is in fact all right. What's the obligation under that scenario?
Well, Your Honor, first off, the acuity contract, all it requires is that there be a report within 24 hours. Secondly, as far as the legal duty to the injured party in this case, and we're assuming the assumption that's 50-year-old, there's not a legal duty upon that person to obtain the information. The legal duty is upon the person that caused the strike. And therefore, it would not change this this case if there was an individual that was 50 years old versus 13. However, the fact that it is a minor, 13 years old, who does not have the ability to contract, is to have these type of obligations placed on a 13-year-old, I think, is more egregious than a 50-year-old as far as facts are concerned.
Well, in terms of the provision of the identifying information.
I'm unaware of anything that in Wisconsin that would provide for a legal duty to be placed upon the injured party to obtain identifying information from the other driver.
So the operator of the motor vehicle struck the individual. Would he still have, under your scenario, under your argument, would the identifying information still have to be provided here?
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, as I hear the arguments here today and the questions of my colleagues, it occurs to me that at some point we are muddying statutory obligations, which were not violated here by the driver because he didn't think there was an injury, with contract obligations in order to have the uninsured motorist coverage come into play. And if Acuity wanted to, they could say to their insureds, anytime you are struck, you are at the scene of an accident, then you have to get identifying information. But they've not required that. And at this point, at the point in time of the accident, the motorist wasn't required, because he didn't think there was an injury, to leave his name and address. So you know, it appears to me the statute isn't what we're looking at here, which is probably why co-counsel focuses on Hayes, which is an interpretation of a contract, rather than being as concerned about the statute. But we tend to muddy them because of the provision that you have to have uninsured motorist coverage and are defining on a hit and run in that statute. So I don't know, to the extent that you can you separate out for me whether you think there is any statutory violation here and whether or not you think your claim is under the statute or whether you think it's under the contract?
Well, Your Honor, as far as the claim is concerned, it's under the contract of hit and run uninsured motorist coverage for caused by unidentified motorist, which is set forth in statute. They essentially mirror each other for that purpose on run.
Yeah.
And looking at what definition of run means, we have to look to other sources for that.
That's right.
And as far as the statute is concerned with the hit and run criminal statute, that's the only statute that I'm aware of that has any type of insight into what's required legally in these type of circumstances.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, maybe it would help the lawyers and the Court of Appeals if the Supreme Court, when it issued a decision, in addition to giving paragraph numbers, it would have a D for anything that had dicta. Oh. That would make us more careful in writing opinions, right?
I believe it would, Your Honor.
Yes.
Don't answer that question yes, however.
I'm going to lose either way.
And, hey, take me seriously because the next case, you're aware we have another uninsured motorist case following you. The issue is when we overrule a court of appeals, is there any life left in that Court of Appeals decision? The Court of Appeals thinks it does. So we'd also not only label D for dicta.
D for dead?
We'd have D for D for dead. I mean, I would have used a different letter of the alphabet so there's no confusion. But then we'd say we overrule O. We'd label the paragraphs we overrule. So people know what we're doing. I mean, that the whole goal of this court is to give certainty, clarity to the law. So what do you think of that? I think you ought to take me seriously. That's the first thing. Even if my colleagues do not.
Your Honor, it's a situation.
Just say yes and move on.
We always take her seriously.
Things could always be clear, always, and all that can we can hope for is that things can be as clear as they possibly can be based on the situation presented.
It's a very, very wise and politic answer, and I accept it.
Let me follow up with a question on dicta, as my palms sweat with the idea of fear that we have to write a D. One of the things that bothers me about this case is all of this dicta discussion seems to be, to me, to be totally unnecessary. With all due respect to the Court of Appeals, it makes little difference if run means flee here. And that's what the two of you are arguing. Run means flee. It said that in the Hayne case. And oh, yeah, but that's just dicta. Who cares? Because what does flee mean? What does flee mean? That, they didn't decide that. They didn't answer that. In fact, when Smith, who was written by the same justice who wrote Hayne, and explaining what Hayne meant, said, hey, we looked at what hit, if you needed contact. And as to the definition of hit and run, we decided on a case-by-case basis. So what does flee mean in this case? And the question is started out, you know, does it mean leaving the scene of the accident? When I asked your opposing counsel, what does flee mean, he said run. You know, But isn't that, I don't care if you call it run. I don't care if you call it flee. The question, you can define it either way. The question here is, when someone leaves, does flee mean leaving immediately? Does it mean, as the Court of Appeals said in its first paragraph, does it mean to leave without stopping? Or does it mean leaving the scene without providing identifying information? And Hain didn't answer that at all, whether you call it run or you call it flee. So I don't even know why we're into dicta, because they didn't say anything about that. There's nothing in Hain that we have to embrace. Am I missing something? Why are you guys arguing about dicta?
Well, Your Honor, there's two ways to look at this. There is.
The answer is you're arguing it because the Court of Appeals is arguing it. But do you think you should be arguing it?
Well, because it can be looked at two different ways, is that, one, is there a definition of run that has already been set by this court? And whether or not that was analyzed and set forth in Hain is one issue, whether or not that's dicta. Regardless of whether the court feels that's dicta or not, if it selects fleeing from the scene of the accident as being a definition of run, how does that apply? What is essentially a definition of flee? And that's
why we're here today.
We get there either way, essentially. And so from our position, respondent's position, is that there's no logical set point based on Acuity's argument of when this would begin and when it would end. And the only reasonable interpretation that we feel is appropriate is to say, when you leave the scene of an accident without providing identifying information, regardless of a stop, that's a run for the purpose of hit-and-run accidents for uninsured motorist coverage, because that's the only thing that can be applied without having to go into exactly how much of a stop do we need, how fast do you have to leave, what happens if you stop twice, what if you talk to somebody. It eliminates all these essentially different issues that arise by saying a flee can't happen if there's a stop. And that's essentially what we're asking the court, is to set a rule, a bright line rule, that run means leaving the scene of an accident.
Are you wanting a rule that interprets the statute or a rule that interprets this policy?
Your Honor, it interprets the statute.
Do you think there's a time element involved? Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's assume that you're in a parking lot and you're backing up and you back into another vehicle. You can't just stop where you are because you're in an aisle where other vehicles are moving. So you take your vehicle and you move your vehicle to another spot, park it, and then go back and leave information. Have you fled? Have you run from the scene? Is there any kind of time element that should be looked at here?
Yeah, I don't believe there should be a time element, because...
Well, did you flee when you took your car and you moved it and you went around the corner or perhaps up the street and parked your car and came back? Was that a fleeing? Was that a running?
Well, Your Honor, within 367.67, that says immediately at or as soon as possible, essentially, as soon as possible after a striking occurs.
So there is a time element to it, as soon as possible.
I guess what I would say for a time would be you've completely left the scene. You're not still in the vicinity as far as being able to still discuss the situation with the person that was struck.
Look, 2 or 3 weeks after the accident, maybe a month, and I'm really worried about this young man. And so let us say I know his name. Maybe I got it when I got his ID, but he didn't get mine. And I call the house and say, how is he? And they say, he's not doing well. He's got a fractured arm and a fractured leg, and he's got 2 surgeries. By the way, what's your name? And then I give it to him. I said, hey, you know, I'm covered by insurance, and even if I'm not, you know, I'm going to give you my name and number and let them decide who's liable. You know, I think I was going at a proper speed. I turned the corner. Okay. He didn't have lights. It's not my fault, but here's all my ID. Is that a hit and run?
Well, it's hit and run, but now it's by identified
It doesn't fit the hit and run policy. You have an identified potential tortfeasor, right?
Correct.
So you've got to sue that person. You're not under the uninsured motorist, right?
If the person is identified, then you're not under uninsured motorist.
So it may matter for 345 or whatever the number is, 346, but it doesn't matter for your policy because now you know me.
Correct.
Well, what about the, I think I'll take up Justice Bradley's cause. Run means leave the scene without providing ID. That's it. I don't care if you stayed at the scene 2 hours. I don't care if you took the guy to the hospital. Ultimately, there was no providing ID, and therefore, it is a hit and run. Assuming you got hit. I'm not talking about miss.
For the purpose of uninsured motorist coverage, yes.
Purpose of your policy of acuity.
Yes.
Leave the scene without providing ID. That's the kicker. That's what run means to you.
For the purpose of the uninsured motorist coverage, yes.
Okay.
I see my time is up.
That's right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brady, how about leave scene without providing ID?
Your Honor, nothing in Section 346.67 extends its provisions to the omnibus statute.
I'm not interested in 346.67. I am interpreting Acuity's insurance policy.
Acuity's insurance policy references hit-and-run accident.
Right.
And
is that a run? Leave scene without providing ID?
No.
Okay, why not?
Because you have to interpret that term, hit and run, in accordance with this court's prior decisions, which gets us back to Hain. And Hain held that run constitutes fleeing from the scene of the accident. Hain didn't incorporate the requirement of the criminal hit and run statute.
I'd have no trouble writing an opinion saying Hain said flee, but Hain said that without any facts, without considering the myriad of instances and circumstances that could occur. And I then would cite a case by Justice Prosser that says it could be ambiguous under certain circumstances and not ambiguous under others. And I'll find another case that would say words can have different meanings depending on the circumstances involved. And so I'm not going to touch Haynes. Haynes is terrific. I'm leaving it go. But in this case, where the court directly looks at flee, we're looking at run, not flee. That run means leave the scene without providing ID. I mean, I'm not going to overturn Haynes. I don't have to. I could distinguish it. You don't like that.
No, I would prefer that you follow Haynes.
I'll go back to G. Should we borrow that?
I don't know if that'd be a good idea either, Judge, because I don't know if you could get consensus on what constitutes dicta.
Well, it's okay.
Judge, Hain has been the law for 27 years. The Hain definition of run has been around for 27 years. And yet in that 27-year period, the legislature has not enacted legislation to change Hain's definition of run.
I can find a number of cases that say inaction by the legislature doesn't tell us anything. Because the legislature doesn't act for any number of reasons, which have nothing to do whether they like our opinion or don't like our opinion. Now, I can also find a few cases that say inaction is very important. So I agree there are cases on both sides. But if I wrote it, I'd ignore the ones that held against me.
Your Honor, I think...
put them in a footnote. I've changed my mind.
Your Honor, I think it's also important that you yourself said the use of criminal statutes is not significant in interpreting insurance laws.
When did I use a criminal statute?
That you noted in...
I may have said that, but in this case, I'm not using any criminal statute.
Judge, the hit-and-run statute, 346.67.
I'm not going to interpret that. It has nothing to do with this case. I'm just interpreting your policy.
Your Honor, our policy uses the same language as the omnibus statute. The hit-and-run term in the omnibus statute is the same term that is in Acuity's policy. And that term has already been concluded by this court to be unambiguous.
Yeah, Counselor, well, go ahead. We have other cases that say use that there are umpteen hundred cases, statutes that use a particular term, but that term is used differently in statutes. And the fact that we interpret it for one purpose doesn't mean we interpret it for another. We got cases that say that too. We got a case that says anything.
Counselor, if you don't prevail, and you may, I don't know what my colleagues think, because we won't decide till we're all done today, but if you don't prevail, what's to preclude Acuity from, in their hit-and-run provisions of the policy, saying if you're involved in an accident, you are obligated to get information from the person who stopped, identifying information, or you can't claim under the UM provision? What would stop them from doing that? Would it be contrary to the policy or, well, you know, would it be contrary to the statute, I guess, to put that in the policy?
I think that would be contrary to the statute, and that would prohibit the enforcement of that clause by Acuity.
Okay. Thank you.
And I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. I want to thank both Mr. Grady and Mr. Wagner for their excellent arguments today. In one of our very many cases, as you know, involving uninsured motorists. We've had any number of them over the years with different fact situations, different results, and we will soon be interpreting the new statute in uninsured motorists. So thank you for your arguments. And with that, we conclude 088P919, Zarda versus Acuity. The court will take a recess for a few moments when our New Glarus High School students leave.